From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Few things generate as much controversy and emotional responses than the current debate around vaccines and mandatory vaccinations. The so-called anti-vax movement has gained steam over years of misinformation and fear-mongering around the dangers of vaccines and their links to autism, among other things, all of which have been thoroughly debunked, but continue to fuel lower vaccination rates. Now, with previously eradicated diseases like measles making a comeback precisely because vaccination rates are falling, states and municipalities are passing laws to enforce mandatory vaccinations. The anti-vaxxers are responding with assertions of bodily autonomy. Examining this controversy through a fresh lens is my next guest, Bernice Hausman, chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Her earlier books include Viral Mothers, Mother's Milk, and Changing Sex. Her new book is called Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Welcome to the program, Bernice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is, as I said, an emotional issue, and I admit that I'm quite guilty of it myself. As a mother of two children, I get extremely angry and emotional when I hear other parents choosing to not vaccinate their children, because I feel that action threatens the health of my own children in the long run and children in general, and our immunity, our herd immunity as a population. So why did you write this book, and what is the lens through which you come to this issue?
So I was interested around 2010, I noticed that colleagues and friends of mine who had children after 2000 were nervous when they took their children in to get vaccinated. And that was interesting to me because it hadn't been an issue that I had confronted. My children were born in the mid-1990s. And even though I was part of some social circles where vaccination controversy or vaccination resistance might have been prevalent, I wasn't aware of it at the time. So I became interested in this topic and wanting to understand why my friends were concerned about vaccines, even if they were vaccinating. So that's how I came to the topic itself. And when I first started to do research on the topic, I was I gathered a group of students together in a kind of a humanities research lab to study vaccination controversy. But at the time, we called it the Vaccine Refusal Research Group. And pretty soon after we started, maybe a semester or two, it was clear that just thinking about vaccine refusers and thinking about the problem as vaccine refusal was not going to be able to do justice to the topic. So we both changed the name of the research group. It simply became the Vaccination Research Group, and then started to kind of purposefully focus on the controversy itself. Rather than thinking that the problem was refusers, the problem or the thing that we're studying is the controversy. And so with that, my interest is in understanding why in a country with very high vaccination rates, a majority acceptance of vaccination, do we have this very public acrimonious debate?
There is an analogy to be made between climate change denialism and vaccine skepticism. There are some studies showing that the same kind of skepticism against science and scientific research that fuels climate change is what fuels the anti-vaccination crowd, that this sense that the doctors or the medical community or the medical establishment has some nefarious reason to be wanting to vaccinate everybody, and that all of that becomes part of a confluence that's very skeptical of science. Do you think that's true?
I don't find that to be true, or I find that, I think what I would say is, rather than saying I don't find it's true, I find it to be an unhelpful way of understanding what's going on. So There is a trend to think about science denial as a large category in which you can then categorize sort of variations of it. So climate change denial, vaccine denial, GMO, genetically modified organisms, those kinds of dispositions then are all sort of variant ways of thinking about the same problem, which is this large scale denial of science. I think that's unhelpful for two reasons. One is it allows people who are critical of the people who don't believe in climate change or vaccine dissenters to sort of say that it's a problem of the way they think about science in general and not about their specific concerns. And so it's a way of sort of distracting from the very specific arguments that people make, especially with respect to vaccination. And the second reason I think it's unhelpful is that you'll actually see many, many vaccine dissenters citing unorthodox or non-mainstream science. So it's not as if they're scientifically illiterate. It's not as if they're not attending to the importance of science for establishing certain kinds of facts with respect to infectious disease and population health, but they have oftentimes variant interpretations of science, and they often challenge science that is produced, scientific evidence that is produced by pharmaceutical companies, for example, that supports vaccination, and their claim would be that certain forms of science research, scientific research, are unfairly biased.
A lot of vaccine skeptics trace their skepticism to a study that was published in The Lancet by a doctor named Andrew Wakefield. And there have been numerous studies after that showing that Wakefield's original study was really quite wrong and was misleading. But that doesn't seem to have changed the fact that Wakefield continues to be held up as this hero in the anti-vax movement.
It's really an interesting phenomenon, I will say. There are a couple ways to respond to this issue. One is that before Andrew Wakefield, there were lots of concerns about vaccination. So his work wasn't necessarily the initiator of contemporary vaccination dissent, nor is it necessarily the most important, even though he has a kind of iconic status. What's interesting to me is, the issue you bring up to me is very interesting. Why does he continue to be I think in Malcolm Gladwell's terms, he's sticky, right? Like there's a persistence to his persona and his contribution to this scientifically debunked connection between autism and vaccines. And I don't study that in my book, but I do think it's an important question to ask. Some scholars have looked at that issue, and one of the things that people have commented on is that he addressed in that study, which has since been retracted by The Lancet, he did address parental concerns. And so I think the place I would start to think about why he is so significant is that he seems to be responding directly to concerns that parents of children with autism have about, for example, gut disorders, which was the topic of that particular study. So I think there are ways to understand the persistence of Wakefield's influence, but I don't think we have all the answers yet.
So one of the other issues that also comes up around this debate is the demographic of the anti-vax community, the general demographic, because of course there's exceptions, but it seems to be a largely middle class or upper middle class educated white led movement. You know, as somebody of an immigrant background, I look at my home country and home countries in the global south who are desperate for vaccines to keep their children safe from these horrendously infectious diseases and who are lacking the money and the resources to get vaccination rates up in impoverished communities. And here in the world's richest, wealthiest, most privileged nation, we have a privileged subset of people who are choosing to not vaccinate. That's infuriating to someone like me.
So I think that that is a stereotype that has some basis in fact, but is not completely borne out by statistics. So the latest, some of the latest data from the CDC's National Immunization Surveys suggests that children are most likely to be non-vaccinated if they are live in rural areas that are not part of not metro, what they call metropolitan statistical areas. So, in other words, poor children who live in rural areas are the least likely to be vaccinated.
But is that by
So that's
choice or by, by something else?
well, they don't. The implication is that the other part of it is that they're more likely to be on some form of public assistance or get free vaccines from the government. So the implication is that these are poor children who lack access to medical care. So as a kind of a proportion of the population, that's the population more likely not to be vaccinated. I think that we do have pockets of families that are highly educated who are voluntarily not vaccinating their children. But even if you look at the measles vaccine, measles outbreaks this year, the largest outbreaks did not occur in those groups. The largest outbreaks, there was an immigrant community in Washington State that had an outbreak of about 75 to 80 cases of measles, and then the very, very large outbreaks among the ultra-Orthodox Jewish populations in New York. Two very, very large outbreaks, one in Rockland County and one in New York City and Brooklyn. And so you have these. You have a sense that there are lots of these educated parents who have other sort of alternative health views, who are not vaccinating, and yet when you look at the kind of really susceptible groups, they don't fit that stereotype. So there's a couple of different ways to think about this problem. One is, and it is that we don't know really the extent of parental concerns. We do know that it can be difficult to get exemptions from vaccination at the state level. You have to jump through some legal hoops to do that, depending on what state law is. And educated parents in the upper middle class might find it easier to do that. Poor parents who may have concerns about vaccines may be more concerned about having the state services come in and either take their children away or have some kind of an effect on their parenting if they dissent from vaccines.
So you're
They don't.
suggesting that people are frightened into vaccinating their children because they're worried the state might take them away as a result?
There are some of our interviews have suggested that parents who are vaccine dissenters are concerned about child protective services. So I wouldn't, what I won't say that I've done extensive research on this topic, but there was a study in 2015 by the Pew Charitable Trust that suggests that so the idea is that the study showed that parents with more education were actually, there was a higher percentage of them that were satisfied with the safety profile of the measles vaccine, and that parents with less than a high school education or less were more concerned about the safety profile, which again goes against the stereotype. So I think that we have a problem. What I would really say, we have a problem with perception versus reality. I don't think we really know what the reality of
I'm
vaccination
looking at
concerns.
a Los Angeles Times study a few years ago that showed that in California there were 150 schools that are exemption rates of 8% or higher for at least one vaccine. All were in areas with incomes averaging $94,500 a year, nearly 60% higher than the county median. So there's a lot of there's other studies showing otherwise, it seems.
Well, I would again. One of the things that's interesting about exemption rates is it doesn't actually necessarily correlate with the vaccination. A lot of parents use exemption, and again, parents with financial resources and a lot of self-efficacy often will use exemptions in order to selectively manage the vaccines for their children, either in terms of timing or in terms of which vaccines they want their children to get. So it doesn't, exemption rates don't always correlate with vaccination rates. And they, and so I, as I said, I think there's a grain of truth in the stereotype, but I'm not sure that it is as widely applicable as we seem to want to make it.
Do you agree that high vaccination rates are absolutely necessary to keep infectious diseases from reappearing and causing massive epidemics?
So in order to do this research responsibly, I do not take a position on vaccination. And I do so with a little bit of trepidation, as I kind of comment on in the end of my book in the conclusion. But I don't take a stand on vaccination so that I can remain open to understanding the various positions that are invested in the controversy. That said, I also reveal in my book, and I will tell anybody that wants to ask me, that I'm vaccinated and my children are vaccinated. So I conform to the vast mainstream of people in the United States who get vaccines themselves and vaccinate their children. And so I think that that's where I'll go with that question.
I imagine, I mean, from my perspective, your research would be critical in examining effective approaches to changing minds for the public health. If taking a strong stand against anti-vaxxers is actually not helping change their minds, is there a better approach to hearing their concerns, addressing them adequately, and bringing them around to the side of vaccination, because it's in all our interests to do so, just as the debate around climate change is something that we can't be neutral around, because it's literally in all our interests to prevent climate change from happening?
So I think that the way that I would characterize my position on this issue is that we have to create common ground in order to, right now, the stalemate and the inflammatory sort of highly charged vilifying debate around vaccination helps no one and creates a climate in which it's more difficult for public health workers, when there is an outbreak of infectious disease, to establish good relationships with the very people whose situations they have to help manage in order to contain various outbreaks. And so I think that for my research really is interested in illuminating perspectives that tend to be vilified, connecting them to common and widely shared cultural attitudes. I think distrust of big pharma is actually a widely shared cultural attitude in this country. And then in order to create common ground for more positive conversations and ways forward toward protecting public health, which I do agree is in everybody's interest.
Right.
And I think you're right to make that connection to climate change as well, that that in order to move forward, we have to actually find common ground among people who have differing views.
Right. And absolutely, the pharmaceutical industry and even historically the medical community has not really been very helpful to themselves in terms of securing the public trust. There have been a lot of betrayals and instances of eugenicism and racism, instances of putting profits above people's health. But of course, every instance and every issue does need to be studied on its own to determine where the truth lies, where facts lie, where scientific research ends up taking us. Well, finally, I'm wondering if through your research, you can explain, if you were to talk to somebody who was pro-vaccination like myself, how you would explain an anti-vaccination person's justification. If they're an intelligent person who understands that herd immunity is deeply compromised, the more people that don't vaccinate, how they justify not vaccinating their children?
So it depends on their reasoning, because of course, people who dissent from vaccines have different reasons. And there are some people who dissent because they don't believe that the government should be telling them what to do with their bodies. But let me take
just an aside on that, it's the issue of government not telling you what to do with your bodies would be fine if your action only affected you and you alone, but where vaccination is concerned, that's not true.
That would be, for the person who believes that the government shouldn't tell them what to do with their bodies, that would be a point of contention, obviously. But I think that shows how difficult that conversation around that particular issue would be. Hmm. Let me take the perspective of the parent who believes that their child has been injured by vaccination. And whether or not this is an actual was an injury that was scientifically proven to be related to vaccination is not germane.
Right, because there are people who are legitimately allergic to vaccinations, and we do need to protect those people. Yeah.
And so what I've come to understand is that parents who deeply believe that their children have been injured by vaccines, they are deeply against vaccinating their children for any more or any other children, and because of the fear of damage. But they also believe that it is their responsibility to tell other parents about the dangers of vaccines. And so what I imagine that there is something very deeply that you believe, that it is important that every other parent know. That is the feeling that some vaccine dissenting parents have about their social responsibility to educate others about the dangers of vaccines. It is a very difficult social context then in which to bring people together, because you have people with deeply felt experiences and beliefs that that collide with each other. But I think it is precisely because it is so so important publicly, when we have outbreaks of infectious disease, to find ways to bring to contain them so that they don't become epidemic outbreaks. I think that that's why we need to find ways to find common ground.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Bernice. I really appreciate your take on this very controversial topic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bernice Hausman is chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. We've been discussing her new book, Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.